I'm Julianne Good, and this is Psych 101. Welcome. We are here to make psychology more understandable with tips and motivation for you, your family, and your friends. Tonight from Tennessee, I have Skyping in Missy Bradley Ball. She is a psychotherapist and a clinical educator. We are going to be talking about the heroic healing journey in trauma recovery. Hi, Missy. How are you?
Hi, Julie.
Good to see you. How is the weather in Tennessee?
It's wonderful. Beautiful. Beautiful.
Yeah, we're having 40-mile-an-hour winds here, so we might have a little technical difficulty every once in a while, which we have nothing to do with it. It's Mother Nature over us, right? So can you tell the listening audience a little bit about your background?
Well, I've been a clinician for 30 years. I've been an educator for 40 years, or almost 40 years, so you can do the math there. And part of my primary focus is what has helped people to get through life challenges and transitions. So that has played out in a variety of ways professionally as well as personally.
So what made you start writing about the heroic journey and doing trainings about this?
Well, I started at the age of four, actually. So my dad taught me the heroic journey. He used a different language. And the heroic journey has been around since the beginning of humankind. Certainly, Joseph Campbell put a language to it. But my dad began to teach me as a little girl about life, and did it in story form about when we hit challenges and transitions in life. And it was helpful in keeping me going during the hardest times that life presented.
Yes, Joseph Campbell, you did bring him up during that, you know, during the training, and a lot of interesting mythology behind the hero's journey. And we all go through hero's journey from time to time. So can you explain what that means within clinical terms?
Well, if we think about it as being a transition through change or loss or trauma, that there are three primary stages that we all go through when we, there are voluntary journeys, such as when we go from being a student in the traditional sense of student to being an employee or moving into our career, when we go from being a non-parent to being a parent, when we join in marriage or intimate connection with another person. There are a lot of times that we consciously choose journeys, and then there are times the journey chooses us. And regardless of whether it's more of a voluntary journey or what I call an involuntary journey, we still go through three primary stages of it. One is the separation, and that's when we begin to lead the life that we once knew. Kind of we leave the status quo, what we're most familiar with. The initiation is kind of the middle ground. And even when we have consciously chosen a journey, this is where things happen that we maybe didn't expect. With trauma, this is going to be the bulk of the healing time, where we do a lot of work in trying to figure out where the new pieces go and who we are in the journey. And then the return is a return to kind of a new normal. It doesn't mean that when we're looking at trauma, it doesn't mean that we are no longer grieving. It doesn't mean that we no longer miss something or someone. It just means we have found new life within the ashes of that. So there's a new sense of hope, and there is a revealing of who we really are at the core of it. So even though it appears that we have changed externally, I think it's more of a revealing an authentic self, or kind of an ownership of self.
Yes, especially when you're being challenged by an unexpected trauma that just drops in your lap. Do you find that people deal with that differently when it's an unexpected sudden change versus something that comes along and you expected, like if somebody has an illness and it's kind of a course of going through that hero's journey? It's a little bit of a smoother transition onto that path versus just being dropped on your head.
I think that some people, when they have a sudden thing come up, a loss or a challenge or something that's very traumatic for them, I call it's like we have a short on-ramp. So we're kind of plunged into the depth suddenly. And even if we have lots of skills in handling that, there's still an adjustment time to be able, there's almost a shock or a discombobulation time that it takes a while for us to return to the things that work for us. And some people can be in profound shock for weeks or even months. And depending on their survival styles, some people are better at kind of hitting that short ramp and getting into the flow of making the changes, and other people are not. And a lot of times that has to do with maybe childhood factors as well.
Would resiliency come into play?
Absolutely. Resiliency, and when we're talking about trauma, we're looking at, this is also a post-traumatic growth piece of what is it that makes some people more resilient than others. And I think that there's some inherent biological factors and role modeling and such. But the good news is that we can learn the skills to be more resilient. And the hero's journey is a powerful, powerful way to kind of prepare anyone to be able to handle those challenges in life. And we can even start that with children very, very young to begin to put that framework in place.
So how would you start with a child versus an adult, getting them onto this path of the hero's journey, especially, I would imagine the attitudes are much different because, you know, children process things differently, period. So what would be the main factor, how you would work differently with a child than an adult when starting this process?
Well, with children, part of it is just being aware of the teachable moments. Children are inundated with stories. Oftentimes now it's kind of mind-numbing entertainment, and embedded in almost 100% of all the full-length animated movies for children, and even the non-animated children's movies, almost all of those are built on the heroic framework. So it's not that children aren't around it. It's that we, as the adults around them, often don't connect the dots. And so we consciously begin to utilize those stories for healing moments. And one of the ways that we do that is beginning to have a conversation about the story or the movie that maybe the parents and child just saw or just read together. And that story becomes alive. And one of my favorite heroic journey movies is Finding Nemo. And certainly we've got the sequel coming out soon, Finding Dory. So I imagine it will be too. But it may be, my granddaughter is now a little over 18 months old. And as soon as she is old enough to kind of track with the story, I will ask her questions such as, what was Nemo most afraid of in the aquarium? And, you know, what is it? Who helped him? Did he get out of the aquarium? Yes. But how did that happen? And have conversation about it. And when children then become old enough to be able to connect it with their own life, it may be, what would Nemo do? Or does that feel like you remember when Nemo was really scared? Are you scared like that right now? And one of the things that my dad always taught me was there will be times in your life that you'll feel confusion. There will be times you'll have doubt. There will be times you won't know what to do next. And then kind of like Paul Harvey, the old radio commentator, he would tell me how in those stories that character or that person he supposedly knew was able to make it through.
Yes, and I think as we're going on as a society, we almost forget those really prime stories that we were brought up with, where there's the moral to the story. What is it trying to teach us? You know, and I agree with you, Missy. It's like, movies can have a very therapeutic effect, you know, properly used, and stopping the movie or whatever, and then just processing it. Why am I feeling like this? What is the characters going through? Maybe I'm going through the same thing, and maybe that can be a start of the process between, you know, either an adult or a child. That's a good, safe place to start.
Yeah, and it also just builds connection and having the conversation too. So as they have all the different frameworks or the scaffolding in place, it makes it a whole lot easier during those teachable moments or during times of crises to help not only reset the child but also the adult. Now, I do need to say that learning that and seeing it role modeled and all through my life until my dad's death when I was about 29, it didn't keep me from experiencing trauma. It's not going to totally trauma-proof your child, but it's going to give the child the tools to be able to make it through life. Life has loss. Life has trauma. And that's a powerful, powerful piece.
So what types of trauma are good for starting this process of the hero's journey?
Well, I think that some of the what appears, I'm not minimizing this, but when I say simpler losses, the loss of, family, you know, the four-legged family member, the furry four-legged family member, or maybe not making it on the baseball team or basketball team, or the things that a child may perceive as a traumatic event. We have to put ourselves in that child's place of the magnitude that has on a child. Sexual trauma, the loss of a parent or a beloved family member, how do we help a child with that? And we can also help build the legacy of what did that person teach and what are the memories that you will have about that person? And those become some of the Obi-Wan-isms that I think are so critical in the heroic journey.
Okay. Can you explain Obi-Wan-isms? I think yes, that's one of your own concoctions.
I love this part of the journey. When we look at the most well-loved, beloved movies and stories in cinema and great literature, we find that there's almost always going to be a mentor element into every story. Now, typically, it's going to be, you know, the good guy, the good gal, the, you know, the friendly monster or whatever. I think when we think in terms of Obi-Wan Kenobi and Luke Skywalker, such a prime example of mentor. The mentor is there to support, to guide, to encourage, to teach, and most importantly, to become the internalized positive message. So when we think about the movie, the first movie, the first Star Wars movie, Obi-Wan did not make Luke a Jedi. Luke was kind of born as a Jedi, but what Obi-Wan did was to help reveal the Jedi within. He taught him how to think, how to hold his body, how to work with the lightsaber. And when you study the movie, what's so fascinating is embedded in Obi-Wan's voice are messages about mindfulness, about focus, and about trusting intuition. He doesn't use those words, but that's what he's teaching. So in every big story, there's an Obi-Wanism, and in that movie, it's may the Force be with you, or use the Force, Luke. If you saw the movie Fried Green Tomatoes, Jessica Tandy is the Obi-Wan, and Kathy Bates is the Luke Skywalker character. And instead of a phrase, it's a word. And it was a word that meant have your voice, own your power, and that was to Wanda. So typically we see some really key phrases in all of the Obi-Wanisms. So if we bring it back to our life, the question is, what are the Obi-Wanisms in your own life? Who have been the people that have loved, supported, had your back, believed in you, inspired you? What would they say at this point in time? What's most memorable? And sometimes we lose track of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and sometimes we lose track of our own inner voice too.
That's right.
Of just remembering how strong we are.
Yes.
And you know, and instead of doing negative self-talk, having, you know, just going within, and as you had mentioned before, mindfulness, deep breathing, having those moments of just getting connected with your true self. And,
right.
You know, that can definitely be part of that Obi-Wanism, correct?
Yes. Yes, our internal Obi-Wan. And a lot of times the internal Obi-Wan has been... the space has been held by someone that did believe in us when we did not believe in ourselves. Now, some people discover that for themselves, but a lot of times it can be helpful to have that friend or that grandparent or that even a book that speaks to us at a deep level, and we discover that the Obi-Wanisms within us.
Yes, and when we come back from commercial break, I'd like to get a little bit deeper into this subject, because I know that you have done work with clients with war trauma and sexual abuse history, so I'd like to go a little bit deeper for the next section.
Okay.
All right.
Therapy Cable is the missing piece in the puzzling question, what is the role of the cyber world in healthcare? Therapy Cable has created a marketplace where healthcare finally meets technology in a consumer-friendly way. We use online technology to bring together various entities of healthcare in one central place. It's easy to access from any internet platform. We provide educational videos on topics like acupressure, medicine, psychotherapy, and yoga. You can confidentially use this information in the privacy of your home. You can stay connected to the provider of your choice, or even see your provider in person. Get started today at therapycable.com.
And welcome back to Psych 1-on-1 with Julianne Good and Missy Bradley Ball from Tennessee. We are talking about taking the hero's journey. If you have been traumatized many times, the process is you will go into shock, you will have times where you will be very doubtful about life and confused. You may not know what to do. This may help you with that journey versus, you know, shutting down or hiding or using drugs or alcohol to numb yourself out. So I find this technique really fascinating because it takes one through the trauma, not around, not, you know, over it. So I think this is a very therapeutic technique. So Missy, can you tell us a little bit about the work that you've done with the clients who have been sexually abused?
Okay. One of the things that can be really helpful is knowing what are the stories that speak to the person. So we begin to tie their own sexual trauma to a story that is about challenge and empowerment and loss. With sexual trauma, there are a lot of losses. There may be the loss of safety. There could be loss of relationships because 90% of the time, the person that abused them is someone that was known to them. There's also a loss of sense of self. There may be a loss of sense of trust in self, loss of connection to our own intuition. There's also a loss of alignment oftentimes because when there has been sexual trauma and the person that was the offender, or what we often call the offender, is often the person that may be providing some level of nurturance, even though it crosses a line. Oftentimes, it may be a person that listens to you or takes you to movies or brings you toys. So there may be the normal human connection that we all have of that sense of connection and bonding, yet with this out of alignment, that something happens that particularly for a child is quite confusing. So this non-alignment often creates a sense of shame, and shame oftentimes does not come to full fruition until a child is moving into maybe the teenage years or even in their 20s. And then when people become work with their sexual self and their sexual exploration, that oftentimes there is a sense of shame that creeps up where there's a sense that there may be pleasure associated also with the sense of wanting connection, but the shame also comes up. So a lot of times we see that the sexual trauma does not become as traumatizing until people come into their own or are in the opportunity of coming into their own as a sexual being, or where voluntary sexual connection gets the opportunity to occur.
Yeah, I've worked with several clients where if they were abused when they were children or teenagers, a lot of times they will just suppress and deny and, you know, compartmentalize that event or the events. And you're right, it will not come out until maybe something triggers that back into existence. And then their minds are going, maybe you should be clearing up this prior history because it is affecting you in the present day. Mm-hmm. So how do you work with clients like that then? Do you start working with them therapeutically and just, you know, do the talk therapy first and then incorporate the hero's journey, or how does that work normally?
Typically, likely. It will be just getting a sense of that therapeutic connection, the therapeutic alliance, as we call it. And then when it appears appropriate, you know, when I can say, do you have a favorite story or a movie that you watch, like to watch, and get the person to tell me a little bit about that story. We have probably about a 90 to 95% chance that that story is going to be about maybe the main character or a secondary character facing a challenge where they also meet with not only maybe the mentor aspects, but they also meet with the antagonist aspects. The antagonist voice is also that voice within that may carry the shame. I should have done this. I shouldn't have done that. And an example in my own life, you've been in my clinical seminars. You've heard me talk a bit about my own childhood sexual trauma. But until I saw the movie or the documentary, The Hunting Ground, I realized I had not told about my college non-consensual experience. And somebody asked me several questions that led up to the fact that I had never told. And I was shocked that I had never told. And when I began to explore that, it was about those internal messages about what I should have done, what I shouldn't have done, et cetera, that actually compartmentalized that. You said that so well before. So part of it is helping them to see eventually their own story and maybe what are the messages that they give to themselves about that. Now, there may be complicating factors like relationships where people didn't believe or people did not support or they villainized or they continued to create new trauma by the way that they worked with or spoke to the person about their sexual trauma. So there are a lot of complicating factors with it that can be long lasting.
Yes, and then that can add to the complication of really trying to work through that trauma as an adult. Because, you know, in my experience, I had so many different ways that people were trying to shut me down and not believe me. And so I understand that also. And it was very difficult to actually find my own voice. And I think along with probably a lot of other abuse survivors, it's the point where you start not kind of almost not believing yourself. It's like, did I really go through this or did I start making it up? Because, you know, you'll run into people like, oh, you made that up or you made this up. And then you start questioning your own sanity, whether or not you've made up part of the story. So it's really difficult for survivors to come forward and start trusting in people. And then, you know, coming forward and trusting professionals. Can you help me? Because there's nobody else along the lines that has been able to help me. But I'm at a wall. I'm at an impasse here.
Well, and I think that's part of the key is first, actually, them learning to trust self. They're trusting their own intuition. And also recognizing their power, their creativity, their adaptability, because as clinicians, we know that it's not unusual for people to leave their body or numb out when those things occur, particularly in childhood. So in some ways, that certainly contributes to the sense of it feeling surreal. It's also, there aren't words for it. as a child. No words for that. So part of the initiation time, or that middle ground, is beginning to trust self, their intuition, repairing or setting in play the trust of self. And that's going to be a key to be able to trust others, or to trust the life process.
Or be able to trust what their bodies are doing also, because your body has its own memory system. And there's been many survivors that have had somatic problems, that have body issues, you know, chronic stomach aches or headaches, or and they can't explain it. They go to doctors. Doctors can't find anything either. So do you do any work with the somatic system also when you're doing this type of work?
Absolutely. I think that embedded in the story is what I call a trauma composite. A trauma composite is more than just a trigger. And a trigger is a reminder of what happened. So it could be a certain smell or certain place, a certain physical sensation in the body. So a trauma composite can be dozens of triggers that get lined up and activated all at the same time. So when we talk about where do you notice that? When you talk about that, where do you feel that in your body? What do you notice happening with your breathing? Because most of us as human beings will stop breathing, or we begin to breathe high and shallow and rapidly. And that tells us a lot about what their survival style is, or what has been maybe the default style.
Right. And again, it's like fight, flight, freeze, and I know there's a fourth or fifth one that has just been in.
A fold or collapse.
Yes.
And they all have different assets. They also have different liabilities. So they all serve a really positive purpose. In fact, shame actually has a positive purpose. And most of the time, it's protective. It doesn't feel that way. But when you begin to unravel it, it's about protection. It's also about, oftentimes about boundaries of self.
So can you explain that a little bit deeper? Because shame for most people can be crippling.
So, absolutely.
Yeah. So how can it be a positive factor in the healing of trauma?
One of the things that I often ask people that the trauma happened maybe 20 or 30 years ago or more, is, and they're still in the shame, is to go back and when did you first start feeling the sense of shame? Ironically, it is often not when the original trauma occurred. Sometimes it may be, again, when they begin to hit more the age of consent or voluntary sexual experience. And that's where it gets connected. And I'll say, what is it that shame does for you right now? And most of the time people say, it protects me. And that is that piece where something is out of alignment. Maybe there is a sense of desire to connect, maybe even a sense of desire to connect sexually. But then there is, I call it the yuck factor. And a lot of times people find this, that it feels dirty or it feels gross. And these are people in loving, consensual relationships may even feel this. So the shame may have been as a part of protection. So it reels a person's behaviors in, where maybe they don't want to be sexual, or they shut down, or what behaviors get tied to shame. And it may be that they begin to self-medicate in some other ways. A lot of times it's also about the boundaries, about keeping themselves kind of locked in a cage, in a sense. And each person's shame is going to play out differently. But what's interesting is I asked someone last week, who holds the key to that cage? She said that it was a cage. And I said, so who holds the key to that? And she finally said, I do, meaning she does. And that was a powerful moment, that she knew how to set boundaries now. She knew how to, she had a voice. So did she need the shame anymore to do that? So it's about moving from unconscious to conscious ownership. But it all comes through the power, the power people have.
Right. And as you had said before, Missy, it is, people do not have words when they are traumatized, because the left part of their brain, the Broca's area, prefrontal cortex, goes offline. They don't have words for it. All they have sometimes are images. Mm-hmm. and smells, and especially, you know, odors can be really powerful for triggering memories.
Right.
And they don't even realize it. They're, you know, they're like, how come I got triggered because I smell tar somewhere? You know, and they don't understand it until they start getting into the work. They start going a little bit deeper and realizing our, you know, the right brain records everything, the left brain goes offline. So getting into doing the narrative work, the EMDR work, the body work can be so powerful in healing that those are basically the three things that they recommend for doing trauma healing, no matter what kind of trauma you're through. I mean, it could be automobile accidents or any kind of abuse, or, you know, that's usually a good start. You know, of course, doing the psychotherapy, getting into it a little bit deeper and realizing now you're in a safe place to be able to process this out. That's the biggest component that I think a lot of people don't realize before they start going into the work, is that I can do this now. I'm not back into the original experience, but I'm in the here and now. And with the proper person, it can be life-changing.
Absolutely. And one of the things, if we pull the heroic journey back in, is it acts as a container. As people connect to stories, they begin to see themselves not as a victim, but as an initiate on a journey. And it begins to change the energy or the way they perceive self. And it begins to give them the opportunity to really own their courage, own their power, own their voice, own their trust in their intuition. And it just helps to provide that kind of universal framework of making it through that and making meaning and making sense for them.
Yeah, that's really a key component to truly healing up, is to make meaning, put it into place as a whole. What does this event, what does it mean in my life? What is it going to mean moving forward? Has it made me stronger? Has it made me wiser? Has it opened up my eyes in a way that maybe nothing else could have opened my eyes?
Right. I certainly wouldn't want to go through that time again, but it has enriched my life beyond measure, or the process post-trauma has enriched my life. But I wouldn't have said that, you know, 35 years ago. I was still in the pain of that.
Yes, I understand that one too. I finally put all my events into proper place, I hope. And of course, you know, certain things can come up, but I understand that now. I feel like I have more coping tools available to me. And, you know, it really puts a person on more solid ground, especially, you know, doing the narrative therapy is powerful. So when we come back from the break, I'd like to go through maybe a few tips and techniques for people to start tapping into their own hero's journey.
The Chicago School of Professional Psychology offers numerous psychology, behavioral, and health-related science graduate degrees at three campuses: Los Angeles, California, including branches in Westwood and Irvine, Chicago, Illinois, and Washington, D.C., and online. The Chicago School prepares students to meet the ever-changing mental health needs of society through classroom experience and real-world training. The Chicago School Counseling Centers in Irvine and Westwood provide caring, confidential, and affordable psychological services to individuals and their families. For more information, visit thechicagoschool.edu.
One-on-one with Julianne Good and my special guest, Missy Bradley Ball from Tennessee. We are finishing up on talking about the hero's journey, a different way of approaching if you've had a trauma history to make sense of it all, because so many times a person will be asked left asking why. Why did this happen to me? And sometimes, many times, we never get that answer. Wow. So this time, working through this, we can put this story into proper perspective and move forward. So Missy, can you tell us about, like, what's the first step of getting onto this hero's journey?
The first thing is to identify a movie or story that you keep coming back to. Is there a book that you keep reading? Is there a movie that you have seen 30 times? You keep watching it. And start there. And a few of the questions that you may wish to identify is, which character captures your attention most and why? Tell me about that character. So if you had to summarize what the story's about, how would you capture that? Who are the helpers in the journey and how did they help? And then, is there anyone or anything that threatens to delay or sabotage or undermine you from, or them, that character, from making it through to their goal or being who they really are, et cetera? And then how did that character change over the course of the story? What was it that was pivotal for him or her when they began to usually a heroic character will own their voice, own who they are, and it changes the people around them. So that's going to be a pivotal part of it. What do you think was the most pivot point in the story? And some stories, you can see the heroic journey with several of the characters. There's enough character development in it, like the movie Freedom Riders with Hilary Swank. You can see the heroic journey playing out with about five or six of the characters. So that's a place to start. And then after you have created the framework of one of your favorite stories, what skills and wisdom do you have that would have been helpful for this character? What are the things that character has that would be helpful for you at this point? How have you been in a similar place where you felt that people let you down? And how have you come through? How did that character come through when somebody let them down? So you begin to tie a favorite story, and it begins to instruct. So where are you now in that, if you compare your life to that part, that movie, for instance, where are you in this? Well, I'm in the belly of the whale time, and I like to use Billy the Whale again because of Finding Nemo. So where are you in the story, and where do you believe that, even though you don't know how, do you believe that you will make it through this? And most of the time, people begin to believe yes. They just don't know the how, maybe. And that's the starting place. Start with a favorite story, and if you go to my website, there are some worksheets that you can download free that'll help you identify different parts of a movie. And there are also free webinars. There's one called Revealing the Hero Within, so you can. It's 90 minutes and take you through this process, but there are exercises in that.
Okay, and what is your website?
It's called theomnibuscenter.org. theomnibuscenter.org.
Wonderful. I think that will be a really helpful tool for a lot of people because, you know, I think there are some people that might be intimidated for getting started, and that sounds like that would be a very good place to start where, you know, is it fill in the blank or
you can fill in the blank. Yes.
Okay. So you can print it out, take it with you, or, you know, or maybe follow the framework and then, you know, do some typing on your laptop or whatever. And, you know, get the process starting. Journaling is such a powerful tool also, you know, because you can be truthful with yourself on a piece of paper and then just go hide it somewhere where you know that nobody's going to find it. Mm-hmm. and just keep working with it.
And then go back and reread. Is there a theme that keeps coming up? And so that's a powerful piece.
Yes. And what would be the next step then after you construct the characters and look at all the protagonists and antagonists? And so, and it says in your book also, you know, that when you're starting the journey, you're into what's called the separation from the known phase, where you hear the call of getting onto that path. And then you have the threshold with the guardians, helpers, and the mentor, which you kind of explained before.
Yes, and the threshold guardian can also be called the antagonist, because a lot of times the people that may speak truth to us may actually be mentors and antagonist clothing. So sometimes the people that maybe plug us in or inspire us most may be perceived as the antagonist, but is the mentor. So Threshold Guardian is a part of that. A couple of articles. There's a article by Reg Harris. He gave me permission to share it with people, that it's called Life's Great Adventure. So I think that just allowing yourself to get used to the framework. The framework goes back to when we think about the movie, the song Itsy Bitsy Spider, that it can be, it's actually very simple. If you tried to listen to Joseph Campbell's work, he's more for the advanced journeyer. It's not simple, but even the simplest children's stories are built on the framework. So the next piece after that is beginning to look at and owning your courage. What did you do to make it through? There's an article also on my website about charting your own journey. And anybody that's listening to us tonight, if you it's called Charting Your Resilience Bridge Activity, and it's a journaling process. And if you can't find it, just email me at heroicjourney@me.com, and I'll be happy to send it to you.
I tell you, that resiliency, that is fantastic. I've used that in group therapy, and it's just a step-by-step process of really taking an event that may not be as traumatic. I think just to get on used to doing this kind of processing work. And I have seen people just transform after doing that exercise alone. So I highly recommend that.
Thank you. Thank you. It has been a great success, even with something very simple, just a challenge in our life to see the wisdom and the ownership of how we made it through.
Exactly, because I think we don't give ourselves enough credit for being survivors. We don't. Sometimes, I mean, it's so much easier to get onto the path of, as you had stated before, I should have done this, I shouldn't have done that, and shooting on ourselves, as I call it.
Yes.
Not very helpful. And instead of going back and saying, wow, I made it through this, and there's a reason that I made it through that. I may not know it now, but hopefully up the road, it's going to be revealed to me through working through the trauma, through just life events, to just believing in ourselves and to have the courage to just keep moving on, and then hopefully turning around and helping other people also. So as we're wrapping up, is there anything else you'd like to add, Missy?
I think that continue to watch your own life, the mindfulness, and look back at times that you've had challenges, what it was that you did to make it through. How has that helped you now? How has it helped one other person because you had that experience? And then what's the positive belief that you hold about yourself as you think about it?
That's beautiful. Great way to end the show. And just one more time, your main email address?
heroicjourney@me.com, me.com.
Okay. Thank you so much, Missy Bradley Ball, for being on Psych 101. I really appreciate all of your wisdom.
Thank you, Julianne.
And if you would like to reach out to me, my email is jgoode8@verizon.net. My office number is 562-209-1837. I practice out of Santa Ana, California. I would love to hear from you if you need any assistance or if you have any future show ideas. That would be wonderful. Please reach out and contact me. In the meantime, thank you so much for listening to Psych 101 again. And I would like to encourage you to return and also check out the other wonderful, great events and programs we have on weplayradio.com. Thank you so much, Jeremy Hansen, our executive producer. And take care of yourself. Take care of each other. Bye now.